All right, welcome to Christian Overcomers, and thank you for joining us for this Bible study. Revelation 13n, 666, Sorrows, Eclipse Cycle. As we begin to calculate the number of the beast, 666, like we were instructed to do in Revelation 13 verse 18, we keep discovering that this number and its factors are significant in ways we never even thought of before. In our last study, which was a two-part study, we looked at something that's often called the magic square of the sun. There's nothing really magic about it other than the fact that the numbers inside this square have a mystical relationships with one another. In other words, there's some profound mathematical things that happen when you're adding numbers up together, looking at the perimeter, and all kinds of things. If you did our two-part series of studies on this so-called magic square of the sun, you have an idea of what I'm talking about. But the most notable phenomena of this number square is the fact that when you add up all of the columns or the columns as well as the rows, they all add up to 111. And in turn, if you add up the total of all these columns, they add up to 666 either way. That's astounding. And you know what? This isn't just some neat mathematical trick. This numeric square gives us some astounding scientific data about the sun's movement through the heavens and its relationship to the 36 constellations. So if you ever thought that the ancients, even the ancient pagan civilizations were like cavemen and they didn't know what was going on, you better think again. They had a much more advanced understanding of some of these things than we give them credit for. Anyways, so long and short of it is that in the process of calculation, we discover that 666 and its factors are astronomical numbers. That is to say, they are numbers that relate to planetary and stellar movements. The movements of the stars, the planets, the moon, and so on. And that's very interesting. Very, very interesting. And among those movements, where we find 666 is something called a Saros eclipse cycle, the topic of our study. Now, before I explain a little bit about what a Saros cycle is and how it works, I should first point out that certain scholars have shown the gematria, or the numeric value, of the word Saros to be 666. As you can see illustrated here on page 191 of the computation of 666. So you got each Hebrew letter, this Hebrew letter here, a shin, or actually this is a sin, the letter sin, 300, your ayin, 70, your resh, 200, vav, 6, and zades, 90. That gives you 666. And he's got some other math here. That's for another time here. But that's interesting. The word Saros itself equals 666. Why would that be? Well, we'll get back to that. But you know what? A great deal of the research I've done on 666 over the past several months for this series of studies has been from a book published in 1891 titled The Computation of 666. And actually, the full title is The Computation of 666 and Its Relation to Anti-Christian Systems, but having reference to a person, the coming Antichrist, who is to be overthrown by the Son, the S-U-N, of righteousness. And it is written by two servants of Christ who wish to be unidentified, which I think is very interesting. It seems to me they just wanted this work to not carry their name, and they just wanted it to speak for itself. But anyways, this is one of those books that you need to read over and over again, because at first it's kind of, it can be difficult reading. And perhaps it's due to our, you know, difference in terminology sometimes, you know, as far as, you know, this was written over 120 years ago. And sometimes maybe it's just our lack of understanding. But anyways, so this is a book that you really have to go over and over again with your highlighter out, writing notes. I mean, that's what I've been, the first time I read it through, I just, you know, casually read it, and, you know, it opened my eyes to so many things, just one casual read. But then I started going back through it and making notes and highlighting, and it's helped out a lot. And anyway, so I've been using this book a lot as kind of a foundational, as sort of foundational material for the research on this, for this series of studies. But what got me was, though this book was published over 120 years ago, I'm astounded that very few Christian scholars have much or anything at all to say concerning the method of computing 666. I mean, besides one instance, and I'll talk about it in a slide coming up. But this work is such a profound work that many Christian scholars should be citing it today. Where did it go? Why did it disappear? Why is it out of print? Well, that's a good question. Probably because usually things that have to do with the real truth are often hard to find. Just like it's hard to find good Bible teachers today. Oh, sure, you can get some good Bible teachers that, you know, they'll touch on the milk and things like that. And that's good. They teach salvation, and they, you know, they get a little deeper than that. I'll give them credit for that. But there are a few that are really willing to touch upon some of the controversial issues in the Bible. And there are many of them. And, well, that shouldn't be a surprise to us. This whole world lies in wickedness. The whole world's deceived, except for those who keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Anyways, so I was astounded that very few Christian scholars know much about computing 666 at all. I mean, most don't go past saying that 666 is simply the number of the Antichrist, or that it is the number of ultimate rebellion against God, or something like that. And I'll point this out here. It says even one. I'll point this out here, and make a point that even one of the greatest scholars of the Bible, E.W. Bullinger, didn't break down 666 into all of its factors. You know, he did some work on it, a lot more work than most people, and he even broke down the sorrow cycle. We'll read some quotes from him in a bit here too. But even he did not go into the depth that the authors of The Computation of 666 did. And What's fascinating is that on page 282 of the number in Scripture, Dr. Bollinger even admits that there is likely a much deeper meaning to the number 666 than he has explained. And I'm going to read it here. From page 282 of Number in Scripture, it reads, 666 is the number of a name. When the name of the Antichrist is known, its gematria will doubtless be found to be the number 666. In other words, the numeric value of all of its letters will add up to 666. But this number has, we believe, a far deeper reference to and connection with the secret mysteries of the ancient religions, which will be again manifested in connection with the last great apostasy. And then he goes on and, I'm going to go back for a second. Notice here, after he says that there is a far deeper reference to and connection with the secret mysteries of the ancient religions, which will again be manifested in connection with the last great apostasy. So when Dr. Bollinger said that there is a lot more into this number 666 than he has gone into here, he put a little asterisk here. You see that there? That means you go down to the bottom of the page and he's got a reference there. And it just so happens that he says to see the computation of 666 published by James Nisbet and Company. The same book I've been telling you about. And what's neat about this is I have studied Dr. Bollinger's works on the Bible for about 20 years. The Companion Bible, Number in Scripture, Witness of the Stars, Figures of Speech in the Bible. I mean, he's got a wealth of knowledge. Of course, I don't agree with all of his conclusions, but he's done a wonderful job researching and breaking down the Scriptures. But I had never remembered seeing this reference to this book. In fact, the first time I came across this book, The Computation of 666, I was doing a Google word search in the very beginning of my research for this series of studies. And I can't remember exactly what I was trying to search, but I found it. And when I was reading this book, I just couldn't believe how much information was in there. You know, hundreds of pages. I don't remember how many pages, 300 pages, 400 pages of the computation of this number, breaking it down into all of its factors. Where before I maybe get, on all the research material I get maybe one or two pages of people often just repeating each other. So it is a profound work where even Dr. Bollinger referenced it as having a lot more meaning. Anyways, for whatever that's worth, I thought I'd point that out to you. But I'll say it again. What really dumbfounded me was that all this research was done so long ago. Over 120 years ago, the ground was broken for Christian scholars to pick up this work and build off of it so that we could meet the challenge, meet the requirement that God says that we would need to be able to do, and that we'd need wisdom to be able to do it. That is to be able to compute the number of the beast. So over 120 years ago, a groundbreaking work like this was produced. And any knowledge whatsoever as far as computing 666 is virtually non-existent. So you know what? I guess you're stuck with a non-sophisticated scholar like myself who will at least attempt to scratch the surface and hopefully a little bit more than that. But that's what we're going to do. We're going to do our best. And if you haven't downloaded this book from our website yet, I highly recommend that you do so. And hey, if you're not into, you know, reading a lot of scholarly stuff and you might, and you feel intimidated by it, just go through and scan it. Pick out parts that pop out to you and highlight it. Make an attempt to research it, this because we're going to bring out as much as we can, and this has been already a pretty long series of studies on this number. But there's no way that we're going to be, that we can, again, I'm trying to sum up things and try to simplify them. Many things that are from this book, but it would be impossible for us to go in depth on a book that has 300 to 400 pages worth of information on this topic. And you might think, well, that's overkill. I mean, it's just one verse of the Bible. Yes, but it's one verse. One command. That is one of the most profound commands in the entire Bible. Where God said, here is wisdom. He who has understanding, let him calculate. Not just count, not just look at it simply as, oh, 666 has a spiritual meaning. That's important. But he told us to calculate it, to factor it out, to break it down. And he told us that it wouldn't be easy. And if God says something like that, there must be a great reward. Probably even just at the attempt of it. But there must be an awesome reward at being able to solve the riddle. Again, if you haven't downloaded this, you can download it for free from Christian Overcomers. It's just there. All you have to do is get on it, right-click it, and download it, and study it for yourself. You can, I think, get this on Amazon, but it is a it is not an exact reprint of this. I actually bought a copy of it, and it's terrible. It's got somebody just retyped it or something, and there's spelling errors, and half of it is just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So if you're somebody who needs to write things down like myself, and you don't just like reading things digitally, print it out. Print it out on your printer. Staple it together in sections and take it from there. Anyways, enough on that. What are Saros eclipse cycles? What are these things? Well, and what do they have to do with the Bible? Well, I can tell you this, that they have a lot to do with the Bible. And we can document this by going to Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. Let's go there. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Interesting. Even in a spiritual sense, when we get down to it, because these symbols have spiritual meanings as well. Continuing on. And let them be for signs and for seasons. And for days and for years. In other words, all time is measured by astronomical movements. Just as God says here, that's what we're supposed to use them for. You know, a lot of people look at, I'll pull up this slide here. Astronomical cycles of time. You know, a lot of people look at time only in days, months, and years when thinking of astronomy. But it goes much deeper than that. And this is by far, this This is not a complete list by any means. I'm just going to point out some major ones here. A solar day, everybody knows that. It's one complete revolution of the Earth spinning on its axis. Okay, so that's everybody pretty much knows how to observe that. When the sun comes up, it's a new day there. All right. Lunar month is one complete lunation from new moon to new moon. Now, I know I might have some people there listening that might disagree with that. They believe that we use a solar-only calendar, not a lunisolar calendar. we've got a series of studies called the Creator's Calendar, and which actually is fascinating. This series of studies is actually blending into that, because now we're back here talking about the calendar again. Interesting. It seems as though the Father wanted us to know some information about this. So, in that series of studies, we got one called Moons Equals Months. And there's documentation there that's what happens there. Anyways, so you have a solar year, which is one complete revolution of the Earth around the sun. And then you have what is called a Saros. A Saros is a pattern of eclipses, lunar and solar, repeating itself approximately every 18 years. Now, this is why, excuse me, let me get a sip of water here. This is why, astronomers, NASA, this is why they can predict when lunar and solar eclipses are going to happen. This is why you can go on their website and you can see, okay, there will be a lunar eclipse on the year 2025 or something like that. It's because they know these patterns. They are observable. You're able to calculate with them. So they happen approximately every 18 years. And then one of the things, there's intermediate times in between here, but you also have the Great Year, which is a complete cycle of the precession of equinoxes. And this happens approximately every 25,800 years. Again, I think I've said we might talk about this more in depth in a later study. Lord willing, we will do that. But basically, one year is, the sun travels through each of the 12 signs of the zodiac in approximately one solar year. But it's not exact. So what happens is it actually, as the sun goes forward through the 12 constellations, at the spring equinox, the signs will start shifting backwards. So you can think of it as a wheel within a wheel. It's spinning one way, but it's also spinning back the other way. And it takes 25,800 years for the sun to be in a different sign of the zodiac, for the sun to go from the beginning of the zodiac all the way around to the end at the equinoxes. And that's called the Great Year. So let's get back to the Saros cycle here. I pulled this off the internet here. It looked like it was a pretty good depiction of how a Saros cycle works. And anyways, you got, this is eclipses from Saros 136. It's from the year 2117 to 2261. So you got September 26. I believe this is a solar eclipse they're watching here. So September 26, 2117. This is the path of that solar eclipse. And then you go 18 years later, plus so many days, in 2135. There's the path of it. So it's still the same eclipse. Because it's not exactly 18 years apart, and the hours are a little bit different as well, it shifts over. But it's the same pattern, as you can see here. So then you go to 2153, 18 years later, and I think it's 10 or 11 days and 8 hours. You have, it's over here now. And then as you continue on, it does the same thing. It's a pattern that can be measured by astronomers. That's what it is, and it repeats itself every 18 years. But anyways, we're going to go back to something here. We found out that 18 and 19 were significant astronomical numbers because we saw them in the mathematical square of the sun. And I'll remind you here that 6 plus 6 plus 6, or triple 6, the sum of triple 6 equals 18. Interesting. All right. So let's go back and look at what we had discovered there from that so-called magic square. We're going to watch the vertical pattern of the numbers develop as we start with 1. See how it filled this column here? Now this one's filled. I'm going to go through this rather quickly because we've already done this in a prior study. And so that column's filled, that column's filled, that column's filled. So notice it's filling up each column, just one number in each after 6 numbers. So we go to the next 6, okay, and it's going to repeat over again. It's going to fill each column. Next series. All right. You see what just happened there? Let me go backwards. So you would expect the next, I got these highlighted in pink. We went from 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Now we got to do 18 because we're doing 6 numbers at a time. You would expect it to be over here where 19 is. But no, it goes over here under 13. It doubles up. What that's doing, and I don't know exactly, it does more than this, but on the surface, what we're seeing there is 18, something's happening. It's being pointed out to us that 18 is a number that we need to pay attention to. Okay, so we'll put a box around that. And then we go 19, we're building our way back out. Oh, right away we hit 20, 2 in each column. That means that 19 is also a number that this pattern is pointing out to us. Again, it's a number. Between these two numbers is the number for many different cycles of time. The Metonic cycle and so on. And the primary eclipse cycle. So there we go, and we build ourselves all the way out, and now it goes back to the normal pattern of filling one number up for each column. Whoops. Got way ahead of myself there. All right. So 18 and 19 play a role in astronomy. But some of you might be wondering, how is 18 really a factor of 666? I mean, what gives us license to separate the sixes and add them up individually? Well, that's a good question, and some of you might not like the answer I'm gonna give. I shouldn't say that you guys won't, but others might not think the answer is complete enough, but that's just the way it was done. That's just the part of biblical computation, biblical math. You know, just because we didn't learn math like that in school doesn't mean that it's not the actual method of computation, or that it is not an actual method of computation. Because you see that method used in gematria throughout the Bible, and so on. In fact, I'm going to read a quote here from page 204 of the Computation of 666. And it reads, it says, "The orderly succession of digits in all mystical numbers." Now, when he says mystical, he just means numbers that, you know, people, you know, whether they were pagans, ancient astronomers, whatever, they considered certain numbers that had to do with astronomy as so-called mystical numbers because they had special properties. But for the Christian, we don't really like that word all that much. If you want, you can just call it a significant number. But I'm just going to read it as mystical, and I know you guys understand. "The orderly succession of digits in all the mystical numbers, which must appear fanciful to many persons, is one of the most remarkable features in the whole system. It depends upon mathematical laws, often recondite, but whose operation is both curious and beautiful. Thus, the juxtaposition of the three sixes, 666, has a fanciful look about it, but it is not really fanciful. And further, this number has a recondite mathematical relation to the triune of sixes." And he points this out, the 6 plus 6 plus 6 equals 18. And you can also go 6 times 6 times 6 equals 216. Both factors of 666 are both computations of 666, or products, if you want to say that. Products and sums. Okay, the system of logarithms, which has proved so invaluable in astronomical calculations, arises out of one of these recondite laws, and it is quite likely that others might have been discovered of still greater utility had the cosmogonies of Genesis been the guide of the scientific men of the day, instead of the case being so notoriously the reverse." In other words, he says, you know, people look at these numbers and they think, well, you're kind of doing some fanciful work with them. What gives you license to be able to do that? Well, he says, if man decided to spend a little time studying Genesis and looking at gematria, you would see that this is part of the way you do computation, biblical math. All right, recondite means little known, if you're wondering what that is. It's little known methods that people don't really know much about. Okay, so I'm going to go to, I talked about Bollinger not breaking down, factoring out 666, even though Dr. Bollinger was one of the greatest scholars of all time, at least of this modern age. I said he didn't really break down and factor out 666 all that much as compared to the authors of the computation of 666. But he did do some great work here on the sorrow cycle and 666. And we're going to kind of read his several paragraphs from his book titled The Witness of the Stars. And we're going to be drawing from pages 178 to 181. And it reads, "The motions of the sun and moon are so arranged that at the end of a given interval of time, they return into almost precisely the same position with regard to each other and to the earth as they held at the beginning of that interval. Almost precisely, but not quite precisely. And that's something that you see a lot in creation. Oftentimes we're looking for something so precise, but then for some reason God has fractions in there. Things that seem to throw things out of balance for the rest of us. But you know what? That's not necessarily the case all the time. And let's read on and you'll see why. There will be a slight outstanding difference, which will gradually increase in successive intervals and finally destroy the possibility of the combination reoccurring, or else lead to combinations of a different character. In other words, what happens, let's take for instance the Saros eclipse cycles. Because they don't happen exactly every 18 years, what ends up happening is over a period of time, and we'll talk about a greater period of time, they create larger cycles of time. Whereas they wouldn't have been able to do that if they were precisely 18 years. So that's God's way of growth has kind of been that way. He doesn't ever have everything always the same. Things are always stretching. They're always moving. They're always growing. Continuing on. Thus, the daily difference between the movement of the sun and of the stars leads the sun back very nearly to conjunction with the same star as it was 12 months earlier, and gives us the cycle of the year. Okay, we talked about this a little bit, and I'm just going to keep reading. This is when the sun's going through all 12 signs of the zodiac. As it makes one complete solar year, it almost returns to the exact same position. But there's a slight difference here, and we'll read about it. The slight difference in the sun's position relative to the stars at the end of the year finally leads the sun back to the same star at the same time of the year at the spring equinox and gives us the great precessional cycle of 25,800 years. Okay, so that is when it's supposed to be in almost the exact same spot as it was 25,800 years earlier. So that gives us a big, it's a cycle of time. It's something we can look up to the heavens and measure to keep track of. Just like we look at a day, we see the sun come up, we see the sun come down. It's a short measure of time. The great precessional cycle or the great year is a large cycle of time. So too with eclipses. Again, if you're wondering, why are we spending any time on this? Genesis 1 verse 14, God expects his servants to be able to understand how to calculate the signs and the seasons. And it takes observation. It takes calculation. All things that require wisdom and understanding. So too with eclipses. Since the circumstances of any given eclipse are reproduced almost exactly 18 years and 11 days later, he's talking about the Saros cycle, this period is called an eclipse cycle, to which ancient astronomers gave, the name of Saros. And eclipses separated from each other by an exact cycle, and therefore corresponding closely in their connections, are spoken of as being one and the same eclipse. In other words, somebody sees an eclipse one time, that 18 years later, they say, hey, that's the same eclipse. Almost on the same day. Each sorrow cycle, each sorrow contains, on the average, about 70 plus or minus eclipses. Of these, on average, now check this out, here's another biblical number, 42 plus or minus are solar, and 28 plus or minus are lunar. Since the Saros is 11 days, or more correctly, 10.96 days, longer than 18 years, the successive recurrences of each eclipse fall 11 days later in the year each time, and in 33 sari, will have traveled on through the year and come around very nearly to the original date in 33 sari. It's 33 times 18. But as the Saros does not reproduce the conditions of an eclipse with absolute exactness, and as the difference increases with every successive return, a time comes when the return of the Saros fails to bring about an eclipse at all. If the eclipse be a solar one, before this takes place, a new eclipse begins to form a month later in the year than the old one and becomes the first eclipse of a new series. This is the history of one such eclipse. On May 15th, the Julian calendar, 850 AD, there was a new eclipse of the sun, and it occurred as a partial eclipse. On August 20th, Julian, 1012, this eclipse, this new eclipse became total. From that time, it has been an annular eclipse. That means it looks kind of like a ring. There's a ring of fire around it. That's when the moon is in a position that is not able to completely cover the sun. That's when an annular eclipse is. The latitude of the central shadow gradually shifting southward, and I apologize for that. I accidentally cut off some of that. But he's given an example here and has moved steadily in that direction until on March 18th, 1950, its last appearance as an annular eclipse will take place. On May 22nd, 2058, it will fall so far from the node that a new eclipse will follow it on the 21st, on June 21st. It will make three more appearances as an ever-diminishing partial eclipse and be last seen on June 24th, Gregorian calendar, 2112. So here's the point here. It's total life history. We're looking at a larger scale of saris together. Its total life history, therefore, will have been 1,262 years and 36 days. And will have occupied, it's kind of cut off here, 70 sari. So approximately after 70 sari, these cycles change. Giving us, again, a bigger cycle of time. So 70, that'd be 70 times 18. I'll show the math here in a minute here. In the above life history of an eclipse, there is not the slightest difficulty as to its identification. The Saros shows no break and no interruption, nor does the character of the eclipse suffer any abrupt change. The district over which it is visible moves in a slow an orderly fashion from occurrence to occurrence over the Earth's surface. Now, the important point is this. Now pay attention. The important point is this, that if we take the prophetic reckoning of 360 days to a year, and the reason why we call this prophetic reckoning 360 days is because all of the biblical end times prophecies given in Daniel and Revelation, whether we're talking about the 3.5 year period or the 7 year period, are given in 360 day years instead of 365 day years. Um, I mentioned this already before. We've done a study. We did a study titled The Perfect Prophetic 360-Day Luni Solar Year. And you can search for that on YouTube, and that'll help out with trying to understand what this is talking about here. But anyway, so if you just take 360 days and reckon it as a year, we have the following significant biblical numbers. In the first place, we already have the 70 plus sari divided into two portions of 33 plus 37. And the reason he broke that down is because of the different cycles that were taking place after 33 years, 33 and 37 years. But anyways, he says a perfect cycle is accomplished in 33 sari, or 595 years, when the eclipse, by a series of unbroken sari, has accomplished a passage through the whole year of 360 days. Or, if we reckon only the whole numbers, i.e. the 18 completed years we have for the 33 sari, the period of 594 years, while the remaining portion of 37 sari makes, now check this out, 666 years. That is 37 saris, which are 18 years apiece. And the whole 70 plus sari, now check this out, makes 1260 years, giving us there 594 plus 666. So he says we have the following figures: 18 times 33 equals 594 years, 18 by 37 times 37 gives us 666 years, which is the same thing as 18, if you add these up together, 18 times 70 equals 1260 years. Now hold on, if this is throwing a lot at you, we're going to kind of review it a little bit. Independently of this, we also know that 1260, 1260 years, is a luni, or is a solely lunar cycle. So exact that its epact, or difference, is only 6 hours. Now that's fascinating. It's just, like we said, God makes things almost exact, but then leaves them just a little bit off, so that it creates another cycle of time, another pattern. To everything there is a season, a time and a purpose for everything. Anyways, we'll continue on here and then we'll kind of back up a little bit. There must therefore be something significant in these numbers. Example, the 70 in the number 1260 with its divisions, not into two equal parts, but into 594 and 666. In other words, instead of taking 1260 and dividing into two, which would give you, what would that give you? It'd give you a 630. 630. It doesn't work that way. The combination is 594 and 666. Excuse me. As also in its double, 2520. That's pretty neat there. So anyways, he says, there must be something to be learned in the occurrence and repetition of these heavenly cycles, which for nearly 6,000 years, I believe longer than that, but this is Dr. Bollinger talking here, for nearly 6,000 years have been constantly repeated in the heavens, especially when we find these same numbers very prominently presented in the Word of God in connection with the fulfillment of prophecy. You know, when God said that here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count or calculate the number of the beast, and that we're supposed to calculate the number 666 to break it down in its factors, I think he had a very good reason for that. we have the great seven times connected, the 25:20 connected with the duration of Israel's punishment and of the Gentiles' power. And then he goes on. But anyways, I want to point something out here. Since we're talking about 37, sorry. And I got it right here. 37 by 18 years equals 666 years. So this is a pretty significant, these are pretty significant factors in biblical numerics. I'm just going to review, step back here and review what we learned from studying the square of the sun, the numerical square of the sun. If you add up, say 1 plus 36, you get 37. If you continue down, just adding the numbers, taking the sum of these two opposite numbers, you keep getting that number, 37. 37. 37. And so on, 37 and 37. So you do see 37 must have something to do with these cycles. And as we just saw, it does, and it breaks up naturally that way. So 37 times a sorrow cycle equals 666 years. All right. And Dr. Bollinger kind of already, we already saw that he broke this down this way. But why is 1260 years significant? Well, this is a long-term view or a factor of something else. We've seen this number before in days. Let's check it out. Revelation 11, verse 3. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. That's 1,260 days. So these are biblical numbers. Again, some call them mystic numbers, whatever. But these numbers are seen throughout the scriptures, as well as throughout astronomy. Whether you're looking at years, your days, or millenniums, or whatever, they are numbers that are significant. All right. And if we take 1260 and we times it by two, or just add it to itself there, you get, or if you double it, you get 2520. Now, 2520 is another interesting number, because 2520 equals the 7 years of the Antichrist. Now, we're talking about prophetic time here, 360-day years that all prophecy is given in. And you can find this period of the Antichrist. It's broken up into two three-and-a-half-year periods, two 1260-day periods in Daniel 9:27. And what's neat about this is when we see these numbers are connected to the different numbers given in Daniel chapter 12 to Daniel concerning the last days. And you know what Daniel said? Daniel was confused. He couldn't put this together. He couldn't understand it. You know what the message God had for Daniel was? Go your way, Daniel. For at the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. And he said that the wise, in the end, would understand these things. Again, keep in mind the difficult things that were perplexing Daniel had to do with these days, with these biblical numerics, with these astronomical numbers. And then it just so happens that you get to the book of Revelation and God's talking about some other great thing that has to do with a lot of wisdom, and it requires computation. of a number. And that number is 666. Do you know that 666 probably still is the numeric value of almost every pagan god? If it wasn't 666, it was either 360 or some other number related to astronomy. I'm going to show you something here. From page 230 of the computation of 666. It reads, the word saros, same word, may not only be written this way, this Hebrew way, but by metathesis. I think I said that right. So common with the ancients. It could also be written with the Zadeh first and the Shin last. Okay, so this is the Shin. This is in the beginning. Hebrew goes from right to left. So if you switch these two letters around, they would do this. This is just what people did. They would write it. There's examples of this in the biblical text itself, in the book of Daniel. With Mystery Babylon, maybe it's in another book. It slips me at this moment, but anyways, maybe it's Jeremiah that I was thinking of, about Mystery Babylon, where they did a little bit of altering the letters to, I can't remember the exact name of what they call that. A cipher, I can't remember. Anyways, sorry I brought that up. Didn't mean to confuse you. The word saros may not only be written the regular way, but by metathesis. So common with the ancients, it could also be written with the Zadeh first and the Shin last. It then meant, so then if they did it that way, it would change the meaning. It'd be a different word. It then meant the seed man. Now, pay attention. Seed lines, specifically two of them, are the foundation of the prophecies concerning the Christ as well as the Antichrist. Genesis 3 verse 15 said that there would be a warfare between the woman's seed and the serpent's seed. Ultimately two men from each family, or one man from each family. All right, he says the seed man from Sar, seed or ripening corn, and Aish, Uish, or Ush, man. By the process of inversion of the syllables that arises out of the hieroglyphic style of writing, this became Usar, which is the name of Osiris in his own language, the Egyptian. Osiris is thus 666, just the same as the Saros. For the order in which the letters are placed, of course, makes no difference to the numerical total. In other words, if you change these two letters around, the numeric total, it's still the same. That the name of this god is sometimes written as Usar or Usar or Ua, meaning boat, and Oas, ark, is a further illustration of the perpetual metathesis that took place when pagan deities were named. In other words, pagan deities were often named by just playing with the letters, switching them around, but it always comes back to the same thing. 666. The number of the beast. Well, There's a lot more we could go into on that, but we're going to kind of wrap this up, I think, here. And I thought I talked about this. Let me see. I think we did. Yes, we did. So as we can see here, factoring out 666 can be a pretty profound study. I mean, you got 6 times 6 equals 36 constellations. You got the 37 times 18 sar equals 666 years. You get, now we know 18 is a factor of 666, and on the list goes. 666 is the sum of the squares of the first 7 primes. And all these things have meaning. And this isn't really even the half of it. I just pointed out some of these things. Where are we going to conclude this study? When are we going to stop this quest? Well, we'll see. I don't know how many more of these we will do. I'm trying to at least point out the way for some of you for further research, trying to get some of the material in your hands. But as far as I'm concerned right now, we've got at least several more of these to go before we wrap this up and move on to other topics like what is the image of the beast? Because Revelation 13 isn't really complete yet. We got to talk about that a little bit. Might go a little bit more into the mark of the beast. So, but anyways, hey, we're not going to rush through anything. We're going to take our time and get it right. And we just pray for wisdom and understanding from our Father. We pray that He can open our eyes, open our ears to His truth. Not so we can have just a bunch of head knowledge, but that so we can apply it in our lives, so that we can look out and view the world with a greater understanding. Also, have a greater understanding of who He is. Because you know what? He wants us to have this knowledge and wisdom. He wants us to elevate up to a higher level of thinking, so that our relationship can gel and blend together. I mean, don't you like that? Don't you like fellowship? Excuse me. Don't you like to be able to talk? I mean, think about it. If you know the Bible, you've been studying it for, let's just say, even just 5 years. You hardly have anybody to talk to about it. Your family, your friends, oftentimes, they don't have a clue at what's really in the Bible. And it can be lonely. And many of you have gone many years without other people to study with. And you know what I'm talking about. And I have no doubt God feels the same way. If we don't take our time to study and to learn about Him, not just surface knowledge, but in depth, I'm sure He feels lonely. Like He doesn't have anybody to share some of His wisdom with. Anyways, hey, do like what Christ said when He was tempted of the devil. He said, man, in Matthew chapter 4, He said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word of God. So see that you study it. See that you consume it, digest it, meditate upon it every single day, so that you can be a Christian overcomer. Christian Overcomers is brought to you by the tithes and offerings of our listeners. If you'd like to donate, you can do so by going to ChristianOvercomers.com. God bless you, and thank you for your support.